Case number 20-5759, Kyle Wallace versus Coffee County, Tennessee, et al. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Justice for the appellant.
You may proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Drew Justice for the plaintiff appellant, Kyle Wallace, and may it please the court, I'll reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. Our contention on this appeal is that the trial judge improperly granted summary judgment to the defendant. On the issue of the Prison Litigation Reform Act, as well as this issue of Monell liability, basically saying that we hadn't shown any evidence of a pattern of misconduct or a toleration of misconduct or any evidence of the jail administrator's direct involvement.
Sir Justice, at the outset, can I just ask you this question? I was curious why you didn't sue the prison guards in their individual capacity. Monell is usually a bit of a challenge, and I just was curious what was going on there.
Well, we did specifically consider that. However, just the fact that it seemed to be sort of more of a, it wasn't like a single guard who you could definitively point to. It seemed to be more just the cluster of them. We are obviously pointing the finger somewhat at the chief administrator, Rick Gentry. However, just in terms of the low-level guards, we didn't feel like it made that much sense to sue a particular guard.
I mean, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Judge.
It was more of a collective.
I was just gonna say you lose under Monell if you don't have a violation by the guards collectively or individually. That's a classic ground for decision in our court.
Well, I mean, and I can understand that. However, we didn't feel like we could very clearly point the finger at a single guard. It just seemed, at the time, at least on an intuitive level, it seemed to make more sense to point the finger at the county collectively, especially since we were dealing with a series of situations. And Monell usually looks at, you know, can you show a series of situations instead of a single discrete act?
On the theory that Gentry was responsible for all of them.
Well, that's part of it. And then the other part of it is just that we show a number of different instances of a violation involving both this plaintiff, and then we also bring up a number of other instances of misconduct involving other inmates. And so,
but just so you know where I'm coming from, the whole point of Monell is not to have respondeat superior.
Right, and we feel like we can get around that by showing, you know, aside from the administrative Gentry issue, we just feel like we can also show a number of different incidents, both involving this particular plaintiff. So you don't need a respondeat superior. We can, a rational juror could, we feel like, infer from this series of incidents that there is a pattern of misconduct at that jail of which the county should have been aware.
Well,
let me ask you this. What evidence do you have that Gentry, I mean, he was, let's say, the jail administrator, acquiesced in allowing these prisoners, or in particular your client, to sit there with dirty water and contaminated water for 2 or 3 days? What evidence do you have in the record that he acquiesced in that, that he had knowledge of that?
Well, I mean, there's a report that's written that specifically mentions them notifying Gentry about the problem. So from that, you would tend to assume that he was involved, I would submit, just from that. But beyond that, the guards told the plaintiff specifically and expressly that Captain Gentry had given the order. And the trial judge refused to consider that evidence. He said it was hearsay. However, as we've pointed out on our appeal, there's an exception for statements who are employees of the opponent county.
I want to ask you a little bit more about Gentry. And about the top person in charge of this jail is not Mr. Gentry, right?
The top person by law would be the sheriff. However, the sheriff has the legal authority to appoint a jailer. That's obviously what he's done here. And technically the sheriff is above him, but there's just no indication, and I submit it would be sort of against common sense to assume that the sheriff is still maintaining day-to-day oversight over the jail. I mean, the whole purpose.
Well, I'm not sure that follows. I mean, Coffee County is you know, a mostly rural county. Tullahoma's there, but, you know, it's a mostly rural county. And I would think that the sheriff might be very intimately involved in the running of the jail. I mean, what else does a sheriff do in the most of these Tennessee counties?
I mean, I would assume what the sheriff would do mainly if he's appointing a jailer to do that part of the job is he's involved in criminal investigations as well as just other sort of political.
Well, do we have any evidence in this record about what Mr. Gentry's role really was, or are you just assuming from his title that he has certain responsibilities with respect to running the jail?
It's not just the title, although I submit that the title says a good bit by itself, but he also specifically says in paragraph 3 of his affidavit, which is item 23.1, he says, as correctional division administrator, I'm familiar. Wait, sorry, that's the wrong. He says that he oversees the day-to-day operations of the jail. He says that he's familiar with all the memorandums, records, acts, and events that are kept in the record regular course of business at the jail. And so if he says,
do we know whether he creates policy or whether he follows policy set by others?
Well, I guess there's not, I don't know if there's a specific document in the record one way or the other about that. And so, you know, one could argue, I guess, that it would be the county's job to refute and to say that no reasonable juror could find that he's a policymaker.
Well, I think you'd have the burden on that if we were in a trial context.
I would have a burden on it in the trial context, but in the summary judgment context, what I'm saying is, in theory, they've got the burden to show that I can't show that. And so it seems like a safe assumption when he says I oversee the whole jail, that he is indeed the one in charge of the jail, and that there's nothing real to undercut that. But frankly, there's just nothing in the record to undercut that. And so it seems like at minimum summary judgment.
Well, did you depose? You didn't depose him?
No, I didn't.
I mean, that is the point of the summary judgment process, to show, you know, you've got a triable issue of fact on this point. And I don't think you get past summary judgment by not asking the question.
Well, I don't know. I guess that's up for debate, but I would.
Well, let me just shift to another thing, which is, I think it's consistent with the questions from Judge Gilman and Judge Gibbons that, you know, let's just say you're right about this, about Gentry. The two statements you have on Gentry are, one, he's the one that issues the initial order. So in response to what Pryor does, he issues the order, says everybody stays in their cell. At that point, he doesn't know what's happened. He doesn't know about the feces. He just knows there's water to spill. And then, as I understand it, the only other statement you have or participation by Gentry is when he goes into Maxwell's cell, well, not Maxwell's cell, and Wallace's cell, and says at that point, boy, this smells bad and let's fix it. And it is fixed. So but even if you, let's say you get through all these other hoops, I guess I'm struggling with why that's ratification, a policy, anything that Manel would allow.
Well, he specifically in his affidavit, paragraph, I believe it's 26, says that to the extent Wallace was kept in his cell following the flooding, he says it was not done for punishment, but he says it was done to limit the exposure of contamination to the inmates or potential contamination. So, I mean, he's effectively admitting that if I gave the order, it was based on knowledge of the contaminants or potential contaminants.
Well, no, wait. I don't know why you're saying that. The policy, he's just invoking the policy. The policy was to clean up. Like, I mean, if you're looking at the Manel policy, it would be to clean up. And so I don't see him to be giving you personal knowledge information with paragraph 26.
Well, the
he's point just invoking the policy.
The point is he denies giving the order, and then Wallace and the guards say he did give the order. He also admits if the order was given, it was done for that reason. And so based on that,
I'm sorry to bother you again, but just when you say order, are you referring to anything other than the initial order?
I thought it was implied that there was a follow-up order at some point.
I'm aware of two. He initially says stay in the cell. And then when he visits Wallace's cell, he says this has got to get cleaned up, and it does get cleaned up. Tell me what else he does where you have firsthand information. I'm looking at paragraph 26. That doesn't cover that. It seems like he's invoking the policy.
Right, but Wallace testified that the guards told him that Gentry had forbidden them from showering and coming out of their cells. So that's the order I'm referring to.
Well, I think there's definitely support for the idea. Everyone was told to stay in their cell, and if the showers are outside the cell, fair enough. What it doesn't show is that Gentry said, stay in your cell, don't shower even if there's feces in everyone's cell, because that's not part of the statement.
Well, he does mention the potential contaminants, but again, I guess my time is up unless you'll have any further questions for right now. I'll come back on rebuttal.
Anything further? Okay, we'll turn to you. I've lost my sheet for a moment. Ms. Vogel.
Hi, good afternoon. Gina Vogel here, law firm O'Neill, Parker & Williamson in Knoxville. It's my honor to be in front of you all today on behalf of my client, Coffee County. Your honors, I'll start exactly, I guess, where we left off, which is, I mean, this case kind of starts and ends with the failure to prove a Monell claim. I thought it was interesting reading the district court's opinion that because there are no individual officers in this case, we really don't start with point number one, which is typically, was there a constitutional violation? So we kind of go straight to Monell. We can start there and go backwards if we need to.
I must say 78 hours or 74 hours or 76 hours, whatever it was, is a long time to have an inch or two of water that's been contaminated on your cell floor. Do we have to debate this very much in terms of whether that would be a constitutional violation?
Well, Your Honor, it wasn't. Of course, we briefed it in front of the district court and briefed it again for you all. I don't think the trial court made any findings as to whether there was a constitutional violation as far as on liability grounds, although I'm happy to go through that. I think we've cited ample case law supporting that, this would be nothing more than a temporary inconvenience of sorts.
Three days.
Well, it's interesting that the plaintiff, came forth with a very specific number of hours that he sat in his cell, but this was a series of two instances, right? It wasn't just one and then it lingered. Unfortunately, it was kind of back to back. But we've gone through, if you compare if you look at the conditions in their entirety, the time and the amount of water that was in there, we cite, ample case law saying that it simply just doesn't rise to the level of an Eighth Amendment violation, and that things like being denied a shower are by law, especially for that limited period of time, are by law not actionable. And Your Honor, I've sure this court is well aware of the relatively recent U.S. Supreme Court decision that came out, Taylor versus Riojas. I'm sure I'm just butchering that name. I think if you look at that case where an Eighth Amendment, at least summary judgment, was not warranted in that case, and you look at the circumstances in that case, they're looking at extremely shockingly unsanitary conditions that last a much longer period. But I think it's significant to point out that the United States Supreme Court said that you also have to look at the whether the conditions are compelled by necessity or exigency. Here, the only proof in this case is that to whatever extent Mr. Wallace and others were kept in their cell and perhaps did have to sustain, a small level of water in their cell, it was done for a purpose, and that purpose is to prevent further contamination from spreading and to prevent further flooding from occurring. That's the only proof in this case. There's no proof of any kind of, you know, deliberate conduct to make any inmate suffer in this case. And so
what's the county's theory as to why the water didn't go into the drains, which, as I take it, are in the middle of the pod and presumably a little lower than the rest of the pod? What happened there?
Well, I guess, you know, I'm not a professional in this regard, and I'm not sure anyone other than, you know, a maintenance or a plumber from the county would be able to adequately answer that. I know that when the sprinkler heads are popped, that does produce quite a substantial amount of water. Perhaps, you know, that amount of water would be sufficient to have some kind of puddling or flooding or whatnot. Of course, the county took the position in the district court that this whole theory of how this occurred is simply implausible and that it didn't happen, as the plaintiff is explaining it. And so, you know, as far as the proof in the record, I kind of have to rely on that and our theory of, you know, I understand your honors could find an issue of fact there as to whether or not this event really occurred as he described it, but the county's maintained the position that it really didn't happen that way.
Doesn't matter, does it? We're on summary judgment, so you have to take the facts as alleged by the plaintiff. It doesn't matter.
Of course. You're right, Your Honor.
So, I mean, if, you know, to allow, say, standing water with contaminants to hang around for, say, 3 days strikes me as enough to be a constitutional violation.
And it may be if there were, if the circumstances didn't present with, you know, a necessity to keep it that way. I mean, the Eighth Amendment ultimately looks at whether the county is being deliberately indifferent. Here, the proof only supports that the people involved were trying to do something about it, whether it be from a preventative measure, as in, I don't want further flooding to occur, so you need to stay in your cell, or Drencrete, you know, trying to get cleaning products for these inmates. And so I don't think, you know, when you take a step back and you look at the record in its entirety, there's just not the facts to support that, you know,
well, Gentry,
any constitutional violation occurred.
Once Gentry came along with the second order and said clean it up, it did get cleaned up. So why didn't it start 1 hour later or 2 hours later rather than 3 days later?
Well, I don't think there's any proof. I think that the proof in the record shows that the complaints were addressed, or, you know, plaintiff testifies that, oh, I was complaining and the guards were responding, well, we're on it. You know, what that means was not developed. You know, counsel for the plaintiff didn't depose anybody in this case. The only deposition was that of the plaintiff. But I mean, our position is that when we look at the case law and the type of conditions that are found sufficient for an Eighth Amendment constitutional violation, the significant burden here, they're just not met. But again, you know, the district court didn't, you know, hang its hat on that. And of course, you know, while we maintain that position, we don't necessarily either. You know, we still have the issue of whether plaintiff is able to prove an actionable injury in this case, and then you go straight into Monell, which your honors asked several questions about. I tend to agree that Mr. Gentry is not a decision maker with final and unreviewable orders here. There is case law saying that even if you have you know, if you have the authority to exercise discretion for particular functions, that doesn't ultimately make you the final policymaker. You just
used the word unreviewable. Does that come from the case law? In other words, if it's found that the sheriff can actually review and override Gentry's authority, is that
right? I'm looking at a Sixth Circuit case, Feliciano versus City of Cleveland, Sixth Circuit case 988 F2D 649, and they say that the mere authority to exercise discretion while performing particular functions does not make a municipal employee a final policymaker unless the official's decisions are final and unreviewable and not constrained by the official policies or superior officials. Here the policy of this jail is to get things cleaned up. And it's also the policy of the jail that, you know, when these floodings occur, which they do, you know, occasionally happen, we do what's
just to clarify a point. Does the record make it clear that Gentry's decisions were reviewable by the sheriff?
That is not specified in his declaration. His position is basically an administrative captain. He handles, you know, administrative type things in the jail. But no, he does not state in his declaration that, you know, everything I do is not the end all be all, and, you know, and that's it.
He doesn't say it's not either, does he?
No, he doesn't say that either. It's just, you know, he sets forth his general responsibilities and whatnot. You know, so he may have had some discretion on this day to order the inmates into their cells because the flooding occurred and he wanted to prevent water and contaminants from spreading, if he knew that. But that's not, you know, if anything, his order is just adopting the jail's policy that, you know, one, that's how we prevent the prevention of water from spreading, and two, let's work to get it cleaned up. You know, I don't see any proof that he was directly aware that, you know, that he acquiesced to anyone doing anything unconstitutional, other than all I see is him ordering people to, you know, get things cleaned up and follow the policies that he did not himself set.
There is proof that he testified that he ordered the clock down to continue during the flooding in order to, quote, limit exposure of potential contamination to the inmates. That's what he said, isn't it?
He did say that. And Your Honor,
and I guess the plaintiff is saying that you can infer from that he was aware of the unsanitary conditions and he ordered them to still be locked down and not immediately start cleaning it up.
Right. Well, Your Honor, I mean, I guess the flip side of that is, what if he orders them to come out and then they get even more water and contaminants on their person and in there? I mean, you know, these are discretionary types of decisions that the only proof is that it was done for the benefit of the inmates. There's no proof of, you know, any intentional conduct to place harm on anyone in this situation. I think it would be pure speculation. Of course, he wasn't deposed, and so, you know, not every question was asked and not every answer was given. But I think the only reasonable inferences that can be gathered from the record is that he had very limited information about what was, you know, going on, and he ordered or tried to attempt to implement jail's policies of cleaning up and keeping inmates where they need to be until the situation can get under control.
Well, paragraphs 23 through 25, he talks about this. I mean, because he's saying, I'm not aware of any deputy that denied plaintiff access to cleaning supplies, a shower, recreational time after the initial order.
Right. And then the only next order you have is him coming in and saying, oh yeah, give him cleaning supplies. So you have a general order, you know, putting the policy into place. Okay, everyone go to their cells. We're not, you know, we're going to try to prevent this water from spreading. And then the next time he doesn't know anything else, the specifics of what's going on. And then he comes in and says, okay, give him cleaning supplies. That's the only proof here as to Captain Gentry. So, you know, I don't think respectfully any of the other theories of Monell theories that plaintiff has set forth have any merit. There's simply no custom of comparable claims in this case. Mr. Justice has, you know, brought many actions against the county, and none of them are conditions cases. He relies on a lot of excessive force type claims. That's just not gonna meet his burden of proof in this case. And to the extent he's still pursuing a failure to train claim, there's, you know, the only proof in the record is that the officers are in fact trained on how to deal in these situations. And there's no proof to the contrary.
I think they got probably liability, if any, is going to focus on did Captain Gentry acquiesce in the continuation of these highly unsanitary conditions for an excessive period of time to be considered to raise to the level of deliberate indifference.
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay.
Are there any other questions from Your Honors? I'd be happy to answer for you.
I think we have none.
Thank you all.
All right, Mr. Justice, your rebuttal.
On this issue of the purpose of the lockdown, I just submit that the county can't say on the one hand, I didn't have any involvement in the lockdown. I didn't have any knowledge of the lockdown. But if I did, I had a good purpose for it. On this policy of locking the inmates in their cells.
But Mr. Justice, just so I'm following this, I mean, I don't see why it's hypocritical or what the tension is. Everyone's acknowledging Gentry's decision about lockdown at the outset.
Well, he's not. He's denying it.
No, that there's an initial lockdown in response to what Pryor does. I thought that was accepted by everybody. But just wait, just bear with me so you're answering the question I'm actually asking. The question I'm actually asking relates to paragraphs 23 to 25 of his affidavit. You filed a summary judgment motion. He says, I'm not aware of any denial of access to showers, et cetera. You're allowed at that point, 56F, to say, don't rule on the summary judgment motion. I need to take his deposition. This doesn't add up.
Well, I mean,
you don't take his deposition, and seems to me you're stuck with those answers.
I mean, I'm definitely not stuck with his answer that he's not aware of any denial of cleaning supplies, because according to my client, he specifically told Gentry about the denial of cleaning supplies and forced his hand, threatened to kill a dog, threatened to commit vandalism at the jail if he didn't get cleaning supplies. And at that point, Gentry acquiesced and finally gave him the cleaning supplies.
Wait, but that's the second incident I was referring to. When Gentry talks to your client is when your client gets relief.
Correct. I'm saying if that incident really occurred, which we're required to believe, then Gentry is lying when he says, I'm not aware of any denials of cleaning supplies, because that whole incident was about a complaint about the denial of cleaning supplies.
But he doesn't think it's a denial because he gives them cleaning supplies.
No, it's he gives them to him after 2 weeks or a week or however long it was. But I mean, that's still a denial. On this issue of Monell liability, I mean, he specifically says, I'm the correctional division's administrator. I oversee the operations at the Coffee County Jail. I submit that this issue of unreviewable, that's basically not the correct standard. Or if you want to say that the test is whether it's unreviewable, then we need to look at whether it's meaningfully reviewable. And we cite in our brief the case of Randall versus City of Aurora from 10th Circuit. And they talk about looking at whether the official is meaningfully constrained by policies not of his own, whether the official's decisions are final, meaning whether they're subject to any meaningful review, and then whether the policy was purportedly made by the official is within the realm of his grant of authority. And under all those factors that they cite, I mean, we would seemingly win on this issue of Pembauer liability. In Pembauer, you had like a county attorney or a county prosecutor who some supervising officers told the low-level officers, do whatever the county prosecutor says. The county prosecutor gave them bad advice. That was Monell liability. In a case from this circuit, Bible Believers versus Wayne County, Michigan, you didn't even have any supervising officers. You just had a city or a county attorney give a directive to some low-level officers, and that resulted in county liability. In this case, we don't have an attorney, but we've got the supervisor, and he oversees all operations at the jail. And so if he did acquiesce in this, I would say that that's enough for Monell liability. It's our position. And we don't concede that the absence, you know, that this pattern of conduct is inadequate either, but we've just been talking mostly about Penn Bauer. So that's our position. We do ask for a reversal.
We appreciate the argument that both of you have given, and we'll consider the case carefully. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.